did some instrumental papers involving instrumentation as well as the, see if I can find the one I was thinking of.
Nothing much. There was one on...
The number 84, but that's not the one I'm looking for.
No, how about 80? You may have been looking at 80, but that really wasn't anything.
Okay, by LC.
Yeah, but this was really just a methodological paper, nothing very special, just because we were, looking at developing better methods for.
Yeah, I'm not clear in my own mind when liquid chromatography became a standardized technique, but must have been early. Was it earlier than that?
Or I would think. I would think so. In fact, yes, much so. For example, in fact, it was being used at the end of the war for separating uranium compounds, and then became used in biochemistry. Really, I would say in the late 40s. I would think that a lot of Herb Sober, who did chromatography of proteins and was one of our neighbors, made a very important contribution with something called DEA cellulose, which where proteins were absorbed. And that paper, I think, was 1954. And I think Dowick 50. And those were used, I'm sure, they were used during the war for uranium and then used for separating nucleotides right after. Yeah. No, so that's a long...
Okay.
That's, I can't claim anything unique in that, I'm afraid.
I'm pulling out, looking at the number 83, which is a review paper. And the quote, it is generally accepted, this is the 1976, that polyamine biosynthesis is intimately related with the synthesis of nucleic acids and proteins.
Well, I think there are any number of suggested experiments there. For example, when polyamines biosynthesis, ornithine decarboxylase, which is very involved and is the first step in making putrescine, goes way up when you stimulate growth. You can also show that you can stabilize ribosomes with the polyamines. You can show that AMBA mutations are affected by whether you have a polyamine deficient mutant. That's later work. So there's a lot of suggestive work involved in that, but still no 100% definitive proof that that's the case. But I think it's still true that it's what we say there, that it's generally accepted that, and we have a lot of evidence, totally for it, but not the clean kind of evidence that we really would like. You see, there's no question. It's very hard. This is conceptually very difficult. Usually, the beauty you're mentioning of enzymatic work and so forth and how it's changed is that you've, over the years, is that instead of doing things in a whole animal and crude tissues, you focus down on a very in vitro system, and people have gotten beautiful answers that have then, despite criticisms of people when this started, have on the whole proven to be valid in the whole animal or in more complicated systems, with some exceptions. In this area, it's a little more complicated because the polyamines bind, they're strongly basic, four charges in spermine, they bind to polyacids. So when you break up the cells in the first place, regardless of where they were before, they bind to whatever polyacids are around. So you may find them with nucleic acids, but you don't really know whether they were there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once they bind, they're going to affect them as either substrates or as or inhibiting nucleases or precipitating them or what have you, you see. So you can get all kinds of in vitro effects. But it's, as opposed to most studies, it's a little hard to go from those effects to what is really happening in vivo. You see. And that's one of the reasons why we've been pushing so hard on getting mutants and finding where they're defective. But even that's a conceptually difficult thing, because even with good mutants, again, we go back to this rubber band story, you get an effect, but then you don't necessarily know that that's the primary effect. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge, really, to try and simplify that, and to find what these things are really doing.
You retired in 1983
from the Corps. Yeah.
The term being medical director, so is that like a rank or something?
That's a rank. That's how they say, like a captain in the Navy or a colonel in the Army.
Okay.
And I shifted to the civil service, and effectively it really didn't represent any significant change. The motivation was a very a local one, namely that Dr. Koop, who was the Surgeon General at the time, even though they had changed, parenthetically, they changed the retirement law because to permit him to be appointed, since he was 65 when he came in, and 64, as I said, was the obligatory, so they changed the retirement age, they changed the retirement to no retirement in the Corps. Nevertheless, for the Corps as a whole, he wanted people who had had more than 30 years service. He strongly urged that they retire. I mean, and therefore it was. It was optional, but it was. There was no reason not to retire and switch to the civil service. So that's the reason for that. It's a pure technical thing. On the whole, it made no difference in salary, because there are rules against dual compensation, so that if I'd gone to a university, I would get my retirement from the Corps and a new salary. But this way, on the whole, we could get little to no retirement until one actually did retire. So that was a pure technicality, yeah. Good, yeah.
Is there anything else in those later papers that...
No, I think,
as you said earlier, you've been continuing in this.
We're just doing area. I think what we're doing, I think the difference is we're continuing it, but using a much more, taking advantage of genetic techniques, mm-hmm. and the new techniques in cloning and overexpression of enzymes, DNA sequencing, and all the exciting things that are trying to take advantage and to learn all the exciting things that are going on now. And so in terms of the work, that's I'm trying to apply all these new techniques to the various things we've been doing. Yeah.
How do you find the training of people coming to NIH today as opposed to 15, 20 years ago, given that today's work is certainly more sophisticated, if I can use that word?
Well, I think it's hard to answer that because we're getting into a more fundamental problem. That's true of most universities, maybe not the very best departments in the best schools, and that is you're not getting the same group coming in. In other words, to a large extent, here and elsewhere, most of the postdocs are not from this country. So you're dealing with a different set of people, so you can't really compare it. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, we were getting people, MDs, very bright MDs, but who had no training at all and picked it up. So it's very hard to compare. I think if you want to compare with the same groups, I think certainly your the PhDs that are coming now, for those who come from this country, have superb training, perhaps more limited though in breadth, not in quality but in breadth, because there's so much to know, and there's much more focusing on in their background. I don't think you get the sort of people interested and trained in a wide variety of areas. I mean, but the people who do come are awfully good. But the other problem is you don't get these people, that they're not going into science, that's another problem.
The question of being narrowly focused, I wonder if that's not a natural consequence of growth of science.
That's right. For example, in terms of what you're saying, at NIH, when I came, we had this small group of commissioned officers meeting in the evening, and you covered everything that was covered at NIH. I learned an awful lot about classical virology, and as the place got bigger and bigger, we started to spend more time on our own seminars. And right now, for example, because as you can imagine, I'm quite busy doing the various activities, but I practically never go to our yellow sheet. We have beautiful seminars, a dozen a day at least, and I don't go to it because if you're going to work in the laboratory and have your own seminar, you can't. So I'm limited, unfortunately, to a large extent, to what I can cover in my own in our own seminar, and what people decide to give. And in that sense, it's broadening, but in another sense, it's narrowing, because you don't get to see the other people. And of course, on purely personal grounds, you don't see them. And a lot of good science was obtained by interpersonal reactions with people from elsewhere. And now the fact that we have 10,000 people or more here doesn't do any good if you don't meet them. And we have very distinguished foreign people, but I mean, you just don't meet them and so forth. So the answer to that is that nothing is definitely a function of that. Yeah. And it becomes a bit of a challenge, of course, even within your own lab, to keep a seminar going, because the whole principle of this seminar that we had was that different people would choose what they want to present from the literature or their own work and present it, and that was gave everybody a broad background. Well, to the extent that you're having different groups, and to the extent that people feel more specialized, then it becomes a little more difficult to arrange this kind of thing, you see. But this is true all over. There's no question in any university. It's the same thing. So,
We have not talked at all about any of your other activities.
Yeah, which I think is probably what most people are interested in, I think would be interested in.
So, I'm just going to stretch my legs for a moment. But,
Do you want to walk around for a moment?
Oh, just to...
We can walk around. If you wanted to, we can walk around the circle if you want.
No, this is fine. Yeah. Just for a moment. And I'm not sure where we should start on those. I suppose the most important one is the JBC.
Yeah, well, that's the main one. And, of course, as I said, I feel sort of badly spending all this time on what I've been doing at the lab and so forth. But I think what most people are interested in is
that's important.
I think there are other... I think, though, in terms of what we have talked about, some of it, I think... that from the administrative point of view at NIH, there are other people who could tell you much more about, you know, the details. On the other hand, I guess there isn't anybody who's been around here, you know, over this whole period.
That's right.
And even though I'm, what I've told you is obviously limited by what I know, it's from a different point of view than you would get from an administrative person. I think, of course, some of the people, some of the very good scientific people who are here, even though they came later, perhaps could give you a little more insight if that occasion arose. But it is true that that period from 43 to 50 was an extremely critical point in the development of NIH and NIH's role in the community. I mean, it's really, as I said before, sort of amazing to me that it developed so well. Somehow I just don't, I'm still amazed, as I mentioned, how we overcome or bypass the usual kind of administrative setup that you associate with a government organization. I mean, the people concerned deserve, as I say, a tremendous amount of credit.
Well, is part of that due to the fact that that administration were all scientists of some sort rather than... You know, people today are trained as administrators without ever being involved in the real operation itself.
No, I'm not sure, because you could argue that both ways. I've certainly found that some of the, not here, but say elsewhere just in general, that some of your... I wouldn't think so. I could see where some of the... Well, perhaps yes, in part, yeah, but they somehow had the feeling of what was good. But on the other hand, you have the other danger, which fortunately did not happen, that very often scientists who are put in administrative positions feel that because of that background, they should be able to tell people what to do, you see.
Okay.
And that has not happened for the most part. And we've had some awfully good, as I say, directors, and we've had some very good scientific directors in our institute. We've mentioned Hans Stetten, Ed Rall, and now we have Alan Spiegel, and they seem to have a good insight. And the other institutes have some very good people. Alan Rapson is in cancer over the years, and there are many others that I haven't mentioned. Jack Orloff has been very supportive in the Heart Institute, and I could go on and on. In fact, the numbers who haven't been good are extremely well. So I guess in terms of...
And were they removed quickly, or...
No,
before
no,
they could do any damage, or
the poor ones.
The poor ones. You said they work.
Well, what I was going to say is I think one of the advantages of the NIH and a disadvantage is the structure. It's not that different from universities, but has certain differences. One is, I think, nobody's really in control, in a sense, has absolute control. There's a lot of checks and balances. That has a disadvantage. In other words, no one has the same authority over a laboratory or a department that a department chairman at least used to have.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a certain disadvantage, that you can't really develop your own program to the same extent without selling it to somebody else. You see. On the other hand, it means that if things are not going right, there's a peer pressure to change things or to rearrange things that can take care of it. And again, that works both ways. For example, departments can be reorganized. Space can be rearranged. Well, if at times you could see where that could be very bad, but it also serves to take care of these situations of where perhaps something is not active anymore. In a university, at least years ago before grants, and even with grants, the people would stay around indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to a large extent, despite what people think outside, that's not truly here. There, despite the tenure system, there are ways of rearranging things. It's also a big enough operation that people, if they're not suitable in one area, can go into another area and be very productive, for that matter. I mean, someone who, say, may not be that good in the laboratory may be very good in administration, or might be very good in directing a certain fellowship or grants program, you see. So it on the whole, it's worked out very well. Now, this is my own opinion. I think if you talk to people outside, you may get, you know, obviously, depending on their personal interactions, you'll get it. So it's, again, I think, I don't know where to start, but the journal connection, probably from a social point of view, is a lot more important than anything else I've talked about, except whatever I've told you that other people could tell you better about NIH, though, since you haven't had anyone on NIH.
No,
I guess that part is, for whatever it's worth, is...
I think it's very valuable, again, as you said, you have a window back on a time when not too many people do, so...
You're not too cool, or are you?
No, I'm comfortable, so whatever is...
Yeah. But I've tended to, just to start that aspect, and then you can continue, for the reasons I've mentioned, I've really had two lives in terms of the work, for several reasons. I have the journal operation completely separate from my lab operation. One is, there's a technical reason, and that is that because of government restrictions, you couldn't run the journal from a government laboratory with government secretaries and so forth the way you could if you were a university, despite the fact that the NIH has been very good at trying to make every possible arrangements to keep it like an academic institution. They still have certain unavoidable restrictions, of which this would be one. In other words, the journal is a big operation now. We certainly couldn't take a half a floor of an NIH laboratory and, you know, and have personnel. It just wouldn't be feasible. But more important than that, I had the feeling that it's important both for myself but also for the journal that I do have an active laboratory in which I'm working actively, because I'm a strong believer, and I hope it can last, that it's important for the journal that an active scientist be running it. Now, I say this very advisedly because most journals are really not, many journals, not all, but many journals are not run that way. I mean, many journals are really run by, for one or another reason, by staff with an advisory group. And I could list any number. Well, PNAS, by definition, even though it has an editor, it really doesn't, well, no, in a sense, it's a specialized operation because it doesn't really have a review policy. But so that's not really relevant. But say BVA, which is is basically run by staff, and of course overall policy is run by the scientific person for the actual operation or not. But I think it's awfully important if it's run, you know, by a scientific person. And then there are other journals, I think, like Science, where Dr. Toshlin, I'm sure, keeps quite abreast of what's going on, but the day-to-day operations are certainly run from the Washington mm-hmm. office, and I don't know how independently or not. And so they're all gradations. Okay, but for whatever reason, I keep it completely separate. And as I say, I think it's important that the because you're only, unless you're working yourself or very close to people working, you don't really know the problems of the individual investigator and can appreciate the problems he has in publication, the importance of publication, and so forth.